folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. So today we're going to talk about an article just published in Critical Care Medicine. As always, the link to it is in the show notes. And it is a meta-analysis on the risk of infection from the various anatomical sites for central line insertion. Oh my God. When I first read this article, it was very, very frustrating, as you can imagine. But as always, when I talk about this stuff, I always like to go right to the author of the article in question. So that's what I did. And when I saw this, well, first I had to bang my head against the wall a few times because I've been spending the past 7 years trying to convince people to not use the femoral route. So that chuckle you just heard is from Paul Marek, director of pulmonary critical care at East Virginia. And he's been on the podcast before talking about fluid responsiveness. He wrote that Seven Mares CVP meta-analysis as well.
And then I sat down and actually poured through it, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. So what brought this on?
So what, you know, so many people still think the earth is flat or believe in the tooth fairy, and it's so difficult to convince them. You know, we have these preconceived notions that just people just believe, like lemmings. So the way this happened was I was trained to use the femoral because that's, God put it superficial just to cannulate. And that's what I did. And I still use it quite frequently. So the infectious diseases people came to me and said, you've got to stop using the femoral site. So I said, why? So they said, oh, because it's the hospital policy, which always gets me going. And if you look at the CDC guidelines, they say it's a 1A recommendation that you shouldn't use the femoral vein. So I said, oh, that's interesting. I'm really not aware of any data which supports that. So I said, well, you know what? I'll look. And you know what I'll actually do? I'll do a meta-analysis just to prove it to you. So that's how this whole thing started, actually. You know, which is most things which I do, you know, kind of arise out of a clinical dilemma or clinical differences of opinion at the bedside.
So most people grumble, and you instead, you perform a meta-analysis.
So I like science because data is what the data is. And I think one has to be really careful how you interpret the data. If you like the data, it's a good study. If you don't like it, it's a bad study. And I think you just have to, because we don't know. Things change all the time. We liked starch, then we hated starch. But you've got to go with the flow. And people, they hold on to beliefs that, like, this is handed down in the Ten Commandments. And that's what I enjoy the most, actually, is kind of challenging conventional wisdoms and things we do without thinking about it.
Indeed.
You know, listening for bowel sounds, it's the stupidest thing in the whole world to do. But people religiously do it like it's some magic. So there's so much voodoo we do which is not based on science. And, you know.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the data. Why don't we start talking femoral versus subclavian? And the results on that were pretty much solidly in the no statistically significant difference range in your plot. But a couple questions arose when I was looking at this. Two of the studies were weighted as 0%, and I believe you mentioned in the article that was because they were heterogeneous to the rest. Well, could you talk about that a little, Paul?
Yeah, so, you know, what I did is I included, I try to be all-inclusive and, you know, not to exclude studies to show any bias. So, unfortunately, there's not a lot of data. So, believe it or not, there's only two randomized studies and eight cohort studies. So, I try to include all of them. The one problem with the cohort studies is one guy, Laurenti, has published about four or five papers, but he uses the same data. So people kind of keep on quoting his data, but really it's the same data set. So he's a little bit naughty. What we did is I put all the data together, and what stands out is that there are two studies in which the risk of femoral infection is much higher. I mean, it really stands out. And then statistically, when you actually look at these studies, they are statistical outliers. So... you know, the 95 confidence interval is so bizarre. And if you do a funnel plot, the effect is out of keeping with what you would expect by chance. So they're statistical outliers. So, and you know, these were studies done in Spain and in Japan. So, you know, it's very difficult to know what those studies mean. And, you know, it's possible that there were kind of local circumstances which may have dictated that. Secondly, these are cohort studies. So there is this notion that the femoral is bad. So it's possible that there was actually a selection bias against the femoral, that patients who were easier to cannulate and were lower risk were cannulated in the IJO subclavian, and then the higher risk patients were cannulated in the femoral.
So I'm going to stop here for a second, and let's talk about what was mentioned during the interview. So what we've been discussing so far is femoral location versus subclavian. And if you're not driving a car right now, stop the podcast for a second and go to the MCRIT site and actually look at the figure from the article. Now, what you're going to see is pretty interesting. First off, almost every trial on that plot trends towards an increased infection rate with the femoral line. The randomized control trial, the one that was done that actually compared these two, trended towards an increased infection rate with the femoral line. Except for one set of two studies that actually pulled it back to equipoise, and that would be the Harrison studies. These are 2 years' worth of data from Wales on all the central lines inserted. And in those 2 years from the Wales data, two separate studies that are linked to in the show notes, it pulled it back to really not being much difference between the femoral line and the subclavian. And that's really what led to the situation of no statistically significant difference. Now, when you look at that plot, you're going to realize something that Paul and I just talked about, which is that two of the studies, Lorente and Nagashima, were actually eliminated from the analysis on that plot. And if those were included, the results would have been 1.75 relative risk of infection increased with the femoral site. Now, that was not statistically significant by Paul's calculations, even with those studies included. But when you look at that plot and you see the number like 1.02 relative risk, that's what those two studies eliminated. The reason Dr. Marek and his co-authors eliminated those studies was because of heterogeneity. Now, I don't want to go into a three-hour-long podcast on meta-analysis. I'm not going to do that to you. But let me just briefly mention it because it's pretty important to understand this concept. When you're performing a systematic review, you get all the trials out there that has data that you could look at, and you try to see if you could put them together mathematically. And that combination of the trials mathematically is called meta-analysis. And if in the course of doing your meta-analysis, you realize there's a lot of discordant results. One study says one thing, another study says another. That's heterogeneity. And what you're supposed to do is explore the reasons why. Now, there's many approaches when you do find this heterogeneity as to what to do. You could take the purest route, which in my mind is saying we can't perform meta-analysis. There's too much heterogeneity. We're just going to do a systematic review. We're just going to report the results of the individual trials and leave it at that. Now, obviously, that's unsatisfying. You could do what's called a fixed effect analysis where you just say, oh, let's just get rid of the studies that have heterogeneity and analyze the ones that are more in line with what you'd expect. Or you could explore the reasons for heterogeneity and attempt to adjust for it. And now all these would have proponents. The tack taken in this trial was to eliminate these two quite large trials because their results were so dramatically different than the others. But to my way of thinking, there's not really that many studies, and I'm not sure that these studies are the ones that are so discordant as opposed to the ones that were included. Now, what Dr. Marek was saying is that when you actually analyze these mathematically, that the way these studies plot out would make these appear to be the discordant ones, but I'm not sure. I'm not smart enough on meta-analysis to say for sure. I do know you have two trials here that are saying femoral is a lot worse than subclavian, and it's interesting that those did not play a role. Now, to go back to the Harrison trial, What I found most interesting, and I'm actually going to write to Dr. Marek to hear his thoughts on this, is the way the meta-analysis was done was infection per catheter insertion. In the ICUs I deal with, if a femoral line is put in for whatever reason, maybe the patient was sick and they had to get an immediate line, maybe they wanted to do something that didn't involve having to find an ultrasound machine, maybe the patient was coagulopathic and they thought the femoral was a better route, but for whatever reason, a femoral line was put in. Most of the places I've dealt with in the past few years, as soon as the patient stabilizes, we'll take out that femoral line and put in an IJ or subclavian. Now, if that is the case, if what I'm saying is true, it means that is a significant confounder that would prevent the femoral lines from showing up as an infection risk. Because if you take those lines out 24 hours after they're being placed routinely and replace them with a neckline, they're not going to have time to develop infection in those femoral lines. That will not be reflected in the plot of femoral versus subclavian. And it also won't be reflected in table one of the study that lists the rate per catheter day. So this is something I find very interesting, is what if the meta-analysis was of studies where the femorals were left in for just as much time as these IJs and subclavians? I don't know the answer here, but that is something that really struck me when looking at this data. So we've discussed femoral versus subclavian. Why don't we move on to the next part of this meta-analysis, which was femoral versus IJ?
You know, for me, I think that, you know, you have to look at the data, and the data is what it is. It's not the best data. But, you know, I think, you know, we would all agree a large randomized controlled trial is the best data. And there's really one contemporary large randomized controlled trial. You know, that's the Parenti study of 2008, which had 750 patients. These were dialysis catheters, which is both good and bad. The good is that patients who need dialysis are usually sicker. I mean, duh.
Sure.
So these are acute renal failure patients, and as we know, acute renal failure patients have a much higher risk of infection. So they sub-selected a group of patients that were at a higher risk of infection, and they randomized them to femoral or IJ, and surprisingly enough, there was absolutely no difference. In fact, maybe even a tiny trend in favor of femoral. And what's interesting is the conclusion of the authors. I didn't tell them what to write. And in fact, they're suggesting that the first choice should be femoral catheterization by an experienced operator in a non-obese patient. So in fact, based on their randomized controlled trial, they recommended the femoral as the first choice.
And that particular trial actually changed practice for me, and I think for a lot of others, in our choice of site for dialysis catheters. But are we really able to extrapolate a HD catheter, which the nurses guard, they prevent anyone from using except the dialysis nurses. The dialysis nurses themselves are incredibly meticulous with their sterile technique. Is that really extrapolatable to standardly use central venous catheters?
I mean, that's a good question, and the answer is we don't know. But the pathophysiology of line infection is the same, you know, because we believe most infections are due to colonization of the tract and infection down the the outside lumen, rather than endoluminal infection, which may be more important in tunneled catheters. So they're still at risk of infection, and clearly the nurses were protecting both groups. So obviously, you know, it would be nice to have a study of triple lumen catheters, but we don't have such a study. And I think we'll never have a study, because I think with current methods of line insertion and management, you know, using cleaning the skin well with chlorhexidine, full drapes, gloves, the whole timeout methodology, the risk is so low it would be impossible to do an adequately powered study.
I think so, that's a very fair statement, that the innovations of the past few years in putting together bundles for placement for meticulous sterile technique, full barrier precautions, has reduced infections to the point where it is possible that even a femoral line, even if it is a slightly greater infection risk, you need an extraordinary number of patients to show it. Is that what you folks are contending?
Yes. And, you know, I think what one needs to do is kind of use common sense, is that I think there's a place, you know, each site, there's a place to put a catheter in each site. I think in each circumstance, the operator neck needs to decide in his particular patient which is the safest route. So that depends on his skill and expertise and comfort with each site, and also the risk of putting it in his particular patient. So, you know, in an emergent situation, in a patient who's in respiratory failure, putting them head down to try and put in an IJ is not the best thing to do. It's, I mean, you know, the patient's puffing away there, and they have an oxygen mask on or rebreather mask. You don't have really good access to the IJ site. So in that setting, it seems kind of common sense, just put it in the femoral. So I think, you know, you have to, you know, I think a clinician should at least be able to put in an IJ subclavian and or femoral. I think a femoral is useful. What I find most useful actually is looking at table one, which actually lists the catheter-related bloodstream infections, the actual rates per 1,000 days, and gives you the number of catheter days. So if you look at that Harris, so, you know, I mean, I think the data is what it is. I think the two most important studies is the Parenti study, you know, because it's a more contemporary randomized study with 700 patients. And then the second is Harrison, which is, you know, they have, it's unbiased, so they have data from every catheter put in Wales over a two-year period. So they have 55,000 catheters. And you can see that the risk of catheter bloodstream infection is really similar across the board. And that's pretty powerful. There was another study which I couldn't include. The problem in meta-analysis is if you have no events, you kind of can't include it. So there was another study which was a cohort study which looked at catheter-related infection. The problem was is they had no infections.
Wow.
So that is pretty powerful. So that's a more recent study which looked at the risk of catheter-related infection, and Cassandra looked at 217 catheters, of which half were femoral. So they looked at so this is a more recent study, 2009, 1,200 catheter days, and there wasn't a single catheter-related infection.
Wow.
With 50% being in the femoral. So, you know, I think it's very difficult to be dogmatic and say which site is preferred, because there's no data to speak to that. The data as it is suggests that there's no risk in the risk of catheter-related infection amongst the three sites. That's the data we have. There is a suggestion that this effect may be that obesity may be a confounding variable. So it was kind of interesting in the Parenti study, the rate of colonization went up as the BMI went up. But again, one has to be careful, because colonization and infection may not be the same thing. So the CDC based their recommendation on colonization data. So most studies show higher colonization of the femoral versus the other sites. But when you look at catheter-related bloodstream infection, there's no difference.
Okay, so let's summarize the femoral versus IJ for infection, what we've just been talking about. When you look at this plot, I think it's a lot easier to understand than the femoral versus subclavian. The results of this one was almost double the relative risk when you chose the femoral site. And that was statistically significant. So double the risk of infection if you choose the femoral route compared to the IJ. And those two studies, Lorente and Nagashima, were included in this plot. Now, if they were removed, then the statistical significance disappeared, but they were included, and I think it's valid to include them for the same reasons I mentioned earlier. And also, the same things apply about the more recent studies where they showed a closer infection rate between the femoral and IJ. I just wonder if that's because study was done using infection per catheter insertion. And if it looked at, and I don't know how it would in this modern age, but it looked at equal periods of time for the femoral being kept in as IJs and subclavians, whether the rates would really look the same. My contention is femorals are pulled very quickly and therefore do not have time to be infected in the modern ICUs. But there's one additional thing to talk about with this IJ versus femoral, which is the only thing that pulled the results even remotely back to equipoise between the two routes is this Parenti study, which is the randomized controlled trial. It was a trial of dialysis catheters, not of standard triple lumens, not of standard access for use of giving meds, taking blood, etc. They were for dialysis catheters. This is what changed my practice to start putting dialysis catheters in the groin routinely. I don't know if it's really applicable to what we do every day in the ED and ICU. I think in the ICUs I've dealt with that HD catheters are dealt with very, very differently than conventional catheters. And I'm not sure if we could really take those results and apply them to the triple lumens that are getting accessed routinely every hour for medication administration and what have you. So I don't know. But this one, the results were an increased infection rate with femoral lines over IJ. Okay, let's get back to the interview. Did you find out, Paul, how they got 1A recommendations? I mean, the one thing we could say from your presentation of the data is there's not 1A data against the femoral.
Yeah, it's because they say so. You know, people say it's 1A because I say it is, not because it is. And it's because of their biases. And, you know, I think it's how can I say, the shocking that we have national guidelines that make such bold statements based on a lack of data. And that's why I think one has to be really careful in interpreting and following guidelines. One has to look at what's behind them. I mean, it is actually quite remarkable that they call it a 1A. That's what kind of got me going on this whole process in the beginning, because I knew there was no 1A, and I looked for it and didn't find it, and it's quite astonishing that they actually give it a 1A recommendation. It's really a D recommendation, which is expert opinion, but basically there's no data to support it.
Now, my fear, what I don't want to come out of this, is for folks in the emergency department to say, oh, now it's okay to do a femoral line. And not only is it okay to do a femoral line, but it's okay to do it without full maximal sterile technique.
Yeah.
And so can you just speak a little bit about that, that when you put in a femoral line, how you're doing it?
So I think with absolutely any question of doubt that, you know, I think the technique of insertion is probably the most important in reducing the risk of catheter-related infection. So the rates have come down in the U.S. quite significantly. And I think it's because of our understanding that in order to put in a line, you really have to prepare the skin well, use chlorhexidine. You have to use full drapes, these little tiny drape things, you know, that cover 2 square centimeters is just not going to do it. So you need full drapes. You need all to have all your equipment. We recommend having a cart, a central line cart. You have all your equipment there. You need a nurse or someone to supervise, just that she's another pair of hands, so you don't unsterilize yourself. And if you do, there's someone watching you. And then obviously there's a place, depending on your infection rate, for antibiotic coated catheters or antimicrobial discs, which get, go around the catheter. So I think that it's the whole approach to central line insertion must be done always under ideal circumstances. If it's less than ideal, it's quite simple. No matter where it goes in, it needs to be changed. So if you put in a femoral, it has to be done under full sterile precautions. If it's not, just like an IJ or a subclavian, needs to be replaced.
Now, when you say replaced, Paul, are you allowing wire changes in your ICU, or has that been banned?
no, that doesn't make sense. So, I mean, we know that the catheter tract becomes colonized. That's how you get an infection. So putting in a clean catheter in a dirty tract makes no sense. So you want to do a fresh stick.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's always such a pleasure.
Okay, good speaking with you, eh?
Now, the one thing Paul and I did not get to talk about is the DVT risk. When performing meta-analysis on two trials, that's all they could find, there was no difference. But when you look at the plot, one trial says IJ and subclavian dramatically better than the femoral site. The other study says femoral site better than IJ subclavian. And when you put those two together, it averages out to zero. But I don't really know if that's what I would take from this. I would take from it that we have no idea about DVT risk. And that's all I think I could say from looking at this data. So I'm not even going to mention it further than that. So what's the take-home message from this podcast and my interpretation of this study? Well, I still think, looking at all of this together, that the femoral line is still worse than IJ or subclavian, but not nearly as bad as I thought it was. Now I'm not going to scream at people when, because of patient anatomy or the exigencies of the situation, they decide to go in the groin. I'm still going to recommend IJ subclavian as the first choice unless there is something pushing you towards the groin. There's no ultrasound available, though I would still say the groin line should be placed under ultrasound guidance. If you're going to do something blind, I would go for a subclavian personally. But if the patient has stuff going on with their neck, or they have high ICP and you don't want to lie them flat, or as Paul mentioned, they have respiratory distress and you want to leave them in a seated position, or for whatever reason, they have no neck, you decide to go for the groin, I am not going to yell at you as much. And I think to give this a 1A recommendation that groin lines are horrible, Paul's absolutely right. Not true. The data is not there to say that. So what's the MCRT recommendation? Stick with IJ or subclavian when possible, especially in those patients with the huge pannus overlying their groin. But if you have to put a groin line in, it's probably okay, but make sure it's done with incredibly meticulous sterile technique. Now, as always, you've done the work. You've listened to the podcast. You might even have read this article. Why would you not want to get CME credit for it if you are an attending in emergency medicine or critical care? If you are interested in getting CME credit, just come to cme.mcrit.org or go to the MCRT site and click on the CME link. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRT podcast saying bye-bye.